Money is so emotional that we tend to make very emotional decisions around it. It's not robots that are making these decisions. It's not people who are always doing the best thing every time. It's people with hopes, fears, dreams, and we have to account for those hopes, dreams, and histories when telling them how to think and act with their money.
Than just a regular gym routine. When was the last time you checked on your financial fitness? If you're feeling like you're falling behind, Ed Sedell is here to help with The Retirement Trainer, a podcast about helping you get into better financial shape. Every week, Ed talks about things you need to know to become more financially fit for your future. Learn about things like how much money will you need, financial mistakes other people often make, and how you can avoid them. Plus, details on The Retirement Fitness Plan, a plan Ed personally created to help you get to and through retirement by focusing on five key areas of your financial life. Learn more about The Retirement Fitness Plan when you visit egsifinancial.com and click on processes. Then subscribe, follow, and listen to The Retirement Trainer on Apple Podcasts, your iHeart app, or whichever podcast platform you prefer.
Daniel, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I am doing great. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's my pleasure.
So tell me about Manila. You guys left Maui and then you and your son went to Manila for how long were you guys there? That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was super cool. So what makes it even cooler? Did I tell you I used to live there?
You did. I mean, you've kind of lived a very storied life because didn't you teach and live in Hawaii too for a while?
I lived in Hawaii for like a summer. For like 4 months. I lived in Manila for 2 years and I am like quite fluent at Tagalog, the language of the Philippines.
Really?
So I was a missionary there. It was awesome. In fact, I think I'm probably going to go back in November. Now, it had been 25 years since I had been back to the Philippines. And so like no one in my family's ever seen it. And we were just like, we're halfway there. The tickets were not crazy. So we just said, what the heck? We were there for like 5 days, which was not enough time with all the trap, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Because that's,
forever to get there.
Yeah, you can't even get on the time schedule, right? But yeah.
It was 18 hours different than Hawaii.
Oh, was it really? You know what? I was having a hard time adjusting from Hawaii coming back here. It took me... You could tell normally I'd bounce back in a couple of days, but honestly, it took me probably, 4 or 5 days to kind of get back on the right schedule. So I can't even imagine going to Manila and coming back.
It was so crazy. I don't think I slept past 2:30 one morning. Like I just could not get right, but it was really fun. I mean, it's so fun. Like the kindest people in the world. We got good weather, which is hardly a guarantee in the Philippines. And it was awesome.
All right. So you lived there for 2 years. You were a missionary there. So did you go around and your son? So how old is your son?
He's 11.
He's 11. Okay. So were you able to show him kind of where you live and everything, or was it mainly more of a sightseeing?
No, kind of where I lived was too dicey. Like, I mean, where you've got to be 19 years old and feel invincible to do that. I took him to Manila is the most crowded city in the world. There's 20 million people in a place the size of my hometown in Alabama that has 300,000. The first day I took him to some of the big markets where you can get cheap knockoff Lakers jerseys and Nikes and stuff like that. And that kid's mind was blown. And there's no white people anywhere. Like, I mean, there's no tourists. And everyone's just like coming up to you, trying to sell you stuff. So after the first day, we went pretty hard the first day. And so after that, I was like, okay, we're going to go out to the country. And it is still a dangerous city. Even when you go into your hotel, every time you go to the hotel, and it's like a 5-star hotel, a gorgeous hotel, but it's like there's bomb sniffing dogs. Like, you know, your taxi, they put bomb sniffing dogs in your taxi. They're doing the mirror looking for bombs under your car. And I had forgotten kind of how dangerous it is. And so after that first day, I was like, okay, we're going to go to like the historical sites and like the fancy stuff a little bit. I think I blew his mind a little bit the first day.
Bomb sniffing dogs at hotel. That's, you know, makes the TSA look, you know, very benign, doesn't it? Holy cow.
For some reason, they all have sawed off shotguns. Like everybody, every bank, every drugstore, everything has a guy with a sawed off shotgun in front of it. And my son is just like little rich kid from a gated neighborhood in Georgia is just like, what? So it was fun. He got to learn a little bit about the world on that trip. So it was good.
That's cool. That's cool. Well, as much as I enjoyed your talk in Atlanta, you know, Maui, it was really good. We read your bio at the very beginning, but, you know, just you got your PhD in psychology. Now you're in behavioral finance. And so, first of all, so how did you make that shift from a psychologist to behavioral finance? Because it's very similar, but it is completely different. I mean, it seems like at one end of the spectrum to the other.
So, you know, I went to 1 year of school with an idea of doing what my dad did. My dad is a financial advisor. But then after that year of school, I did some general ed. I was missionary in Manila for a couple of years, and I came back going from this kid from Alabama to, you know, Southeast Asia and living for 2 years. Your mind is expanded by seeing different cultures and different ways of being and different ways of acting. And I came back completely fascinated with people. And so I said, look, I've got to study human behavior. I've got to study psychology. About this same time, someone very close to me had developed a very serious eating disorder. And she was in inpatient treatment in Utah where I was going to school. And so I became a sort of intermediary between my friend and her family. And I was kind of the one checking up on her and taking her out when she had a day off or something like that. And so I was interfacing with the doctors and seeing how important the work they did was. And so I just fell deeper in love with psychology. So that really kind of the combination of the mission and that experience really put me on a path for psychology. And I started my PhD 3 days after I finished my bachelor's degree. I was just like straight on, knew what I wanted. Well, toward the end of my PhD, you have to do thousands of hours of counseling, face-to-face counseling in completion of your hours. I was burnt out. I was all of 27 years old when I was finishing up my PhD, but I was working with people with ankle bracelets, you know, court-ordered folks and different folks who, you know, just heavy stuff, like seeing very heavy stuff at a young age. And I said, look, I still love studying humanity. I love studying human behavior, but I think I want to do it in a non-medical, non-clinical context. So I went to my father, who, you know, is a financial advisor. And I said, Dad, I want to study human behavior, but I don't think I want to do it in this context. Do you have any ideas? And he said, well, there's a ton of psychology in my work. And that shocked me because I had always, you know, in my naivete, had always conceptualized of my father as sort of one part stock picker and one part sales guy. That's sort of who he was, sort of an asset gatherer who, you know, looked at charts and picked stocks. That's sort of what he did in my mind. And so this is, you know, whatever, 16, 17 years ago, my dad, who's an advisor in North Alabama, where I grew up, didn't know anything about behavioral economics or behavioral finance per se, but he knew that his work was profoundly relational. He knew that his work was behavioral and that he had an intuition that some of the best things he did for his clients were to keep them invested and keep them motivated and keep them focused on their goals. So to make a very long road short, that is the conversation that put me on the path to try and be a translator between the ivory tower of academia and people like you, people like my father, who are in the trenches every day with clients doing the work I saw an opportunity to say, look, there's a lot of cool research being done here in behavioral finance, but it's not trickling down to the people who are doing the work. And I speak both languages, and I think I can be a translator.
Well, you know what? That's a great term, because you take the very complicated and you simplify it so that even someone like myself could understand it in your books, in your talks, and everything else. And a lot of it doesn't seem like it should be, but it really is kind of common sense. You know, when you're talking about behavioral finance and having a purpose, I mean, you were kind enough to give kind of a preview of the first five chapters of your new book, which is great. I've actually finished reading this on the way down to Atlanta the first time I heard you speak. And there's a lot of things in there that I didn't realize were behavioral finance that we were already doing, like rules-based investing and just, you know, some of the other things that you talk about. So when we talk about behavioral finance, how can you simplify that so that people understand? It just seems almost like a generic term.
I'll give you the Alabama definition, the Alabama guy definition.
Right? There we go. Roll Tide. All right.
I'm actually War Eagle. We got a big game tomorrow. But
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Yeah. So behavioral finance is just finance that accounts for the messiness of human nature. You know, there's a more technical definition of that. But if you look at the old econometric models, old models of finance and economics were built on the assumption that humans were utility maximizers. So utility maximizers means we always make decisions that are in our best interests. And I don't know about how you've lived your life and the decisions you've made, but I haven't always, not every decision I've ever made has been optimal for the, you know, the kind of person I want to be and the kind of life I want to lead. And so that's more true of money than just about anything, because money is so emotional. Talk more about that in a second, but money is so emotional that we tend to make very emotional decisions around it. So behavioral finance is just saying, hey, it's not robots that are making these decisions. It's not people who are always doing the best thing every time. It's people with hopes, fears, dreams, histories, and we have to account for those hopes, dreams, and histories when telling them how to think and act with their money.
As you were going through logging in these thousands of hours, was there a common denominator that you saw with your dad's clients or in clients in general, you know, the general public that was consistent all the way across the board?
Things that people did that to make mistakes with their money?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's really four that I talk about. So it's ego, emotion, attention, and conservatism. So if I may, I'll touch on each of those briefly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So ego is just the various flavors of our human overconfidence. We tend to think that we're smarter than average, that we're luckier than average, and that we're more knowledge about the future than we actually are. So this constellation of different, you know, flavors of overconfidence means, you know, we don't always get the help we need. We might trade too much. We might do too much. We might save too little because we think that, you know, bad stuff happens to other people and I'm different. I'm special. I know better. And so ego is I see you smiling.
Yes. Ego, yes.
A big one.
Right.
Yeah. So the second one is emotion. We have evolved to sort of privilege our heart over our head. And again, money is this profoundly emotional topic. So we have these intuitions, we have these desires, we have these urges with money. And candidly, they're usually wrong. Like there's places where intuition and emotion serve us very well. We tend to be very good at sizing each other up. Like if you meet someone and they kind of give you the creeps or you don't like them or you feel like they may not be the best, you're probably right. Like there's probably something there. We're quite good at using intuition and emotion in some places,
mm-hmm. But
we're quite bad at it with money. And there's some reasons why that's the case, but our intuitions about money tend to be wrong. And when it comes to capital markets in particular, we tend to feel the safest or the most enthusiastic when stocks are the most expensive, and we tend to feel the most fear when the opportunity is the largest. And so we're almost 180 degrees backwards of where we ought to be with respect to emotion and money. So that's when we got to get straight. Attention has largely to do with our media diet and the kinds of things we pay attention to. We tend to confuse things that are loud with things that are likely. An easy example of this, I think I talked about it at our meeting in Hawaii. When I lived in Hawaii previously for a summer with my wife when we were newlyweds, the very first show I watched upon arrival in Hawaii was Shark Week on Discovery Channel, which is a huge problem, as it turns out. That's not the first thing you want to see when you get to Hawaii. Well, I scarcely got in the water above my knees when we were in Hawaii for 4 months. And then I got home and I start reading up on the actual probability of being bitten by a shark. And it's like, you're more likely for your pajamas to catch on fire. Like, you're more likely to die in a shaving accident. I mean, it's just like, it's just, you know, it's so remote. And yet it was very, the psychological term for it is salient. It was easy for me to imagine. And so investors do the same thing. They confuse things that are loud with things that are likely. So something that's loud would be like a depression or a recession. So what's happening is investors are always tuned in for like, when's the big one going to come? Like, you know, when's the next great financial crisis going to come? All the while they're ignoring, you know, the fact that they're uninvested and inflation's killing their wealth, or they're paying too high of fees in one area of their life, or they're not worried about the engine of their wealth, which is their earning power, and they need to go back to school or get that trade certification. So we tend to focus on sort of high impact but improbable things and ignore some of the daily grind that's much more likely to get you. And then the last one is conservatism. Conservatism is our tendency to be status quo prone and risk averse. We like what we know and we like stuff that's safe. And so this leads people to fail to invest internationally. It leads people to over index on maybe the industry that they're working in and sort of own too much there, and to not take enough risk. So these are sort of the four big human tendencies: the ego, emotion, conservatism, and attention.
Yeah. And, you know, you're talking about the news and commentators or pundits. You know, I always use the saying, if it bleeds, it leads, right? You know, it's if the sky is not falling, then they're not getting the viewership and people aren't paying attention. And so they like to drive that panic to a certain degree so that people react. And if they don't have a system or a process in place, they will act usually to their detriment, at least from our experience doing this over the years. So in your book, one of your books, you know, you talk about rule-based investing. Actually, you talk about rule-based behavioral investing. So when we invest, I'm severely OCD. Everything is a process, right? It's all about the rules, because we do take the emotion out of it and it's automated to a certain degree. But when you add rule-based behavioral, is there a difference between the two?
Really, the rule-based behavioral investing was an attempt for me to sneak in a baseball reference because it's RBI. I'm a big baseball guy. I think what I'm advocating there is largely what you're talking about as well. What we find in the research is, and this is hard for people to get their brains around, but in many endeavors that require human discretion, most endeavors that require human discretion, simple rules beat even PhD level knowledge time and time again. And they're faster, they're cheaper, they're you know, not only are they better, they're faster, they're cheaper, they're easier to follow. So we don't like this idea. We like the idea that we should be paying a bunch of PhD wizards to go through and find us the next hot stock. And we want to believe that there's something to that. The research shows that there really isn't, and that simple checklists, simple processes, and simple rules are a much better guide Because when humans get involved, things again get messy. And what we see is this works for diagnosing patients, which I mean, I think is largely going to be an AI endeavor in the years to come. Everything from diagnosing patients to determining who gets out of prison. One of my favorite studies from one of my books, we've got 1% of our US population in jail at any given time, which is staggering. One of the things that we're always trying to do is decide, you know, who needs to stay and like who's been rehabilitated. And so historically, what they've done is they've brought people like me in, you know, people with fancy degrees in human behavior. And I look them in the eyes and, you know, ask them if they've found religion and if they've changed their ways and if they're a new person. And people, even experts, are shockingly bad at determining who's rehabilitated and who's not. And people's tendency to reoffend is dramatically high. What they've done now is they've switched to two basic rules. The two things they look at now are they're not going to ask you if you're reading scripture or if you've helped a little old lady across the road or anything like that. They're going to say, what were you in for? What brought you to prison in the first place? Like, how violent, how bad was it? Mm-hmm. And then how did you act while you were here? They're not going to ask you if you're reformed. We're just going to look at your behavior. And those two things have led to a nearly 400% increase in the efficacy of judgments about who's reformed and who's not. You don't need a panel of PhDs. You just look at two things. Same thing is true of markets. I mean, if you just get a couple of things right, a couple of the most important things, and I talk about, you know, your mileage may vary, my most important things, things like price, things like quality, things like momentum, when you're talking about creating a portfolio, you get a couple of those things right, it goes a very long way, and you can do it more quickly and more affordably.
It almost seems too simple. It really does. So, you know, when we're talking about that and keeping it simple, so does it make more sense to, instead of trying to pick stocks, go along the way of passive investments or to truly have a rule-based system to do what you just did or what you just explained in the prison system?
So I will answer your question. I want to talk about this too simple thing.
Yeah.
You're a very fit guy. The only reason I did your podcast is so I could ask you for the arm workout once we're done here, right? So in the last year and a half, I've really like taken my health back and I've lost a bunch of weight. And people see this in me and they'll ask me, what did you do? And I tell them, I'm like, I was in a protein surplus and a calorie deficit. That's all. And they're like, but what else? Are you working out 3 hours a day? Are you taking, you know, Ozempic? Are you taking drugs? Are you doing this? Are you doing special exercise? I'm like, no, literally that is it. Like, that is the only thing I have changed. And it has revolutionized my health. And no one can believe it's that easy. Of course, it's not that easy. I mean, like, doing it is hard.
Right.
But the power of consistently following best practices day after day after day is enormous. And sometimes I call these River Jordan problems. There's a story in the Bible, if we can go there for a second.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
There's a story in the Bible where Naaman is this powerful military and civic leader. And he has a big problem, though. He has leprosy. He has this horrible skin condition. And he has this horrible disease. And so he goes to the holy man and he says, hey, you got to help me. Like, I got this leprosy. Help me. How do I get rid of this? And the holy man says, hey, the prophet says, hey, you got to go bathe in the River Jordan 7 times. Go bathe in the River Jordan. And Naaman, who's this rich, powerful guy, goes, what are you talking about? Like, the River Jordan is gross. Like, it's not even a nice river. I got better rivers that I could go to. Why would I go here? And one of his servants comes to him and says, Master, if he had asked you to do something hard, you would have done it. So just do the thing. Like, you know, just do the thing he asked you to do. And then he does it and he's healed. Like, that's our financial lives so many times. The answers are, they're simple, but they're not easy. But it's like diet and exercise, right? It's simple, but it's not easy. And people want it to be more complex than it is. So now, finally, after a small sermon answering your question.
No, that's great. That's right. Because it does. It takes discipline, right? In any. Yeah. And that's, discipline is hard.
So stocks versus ETFs versus mutual funds, it kind of doesn't matter. Like, I mean, I wrote the book because I do believe there is a way to invest that's a little better. But for 90% of the world, could they get to where they need to be with a pretty simple setup? Absolutely. If they're consistent and they do those, they don't fall prey to this River Jordan fallacy of thinking that it has to be complex for it to be impactful.
Yeah, I think in one of your books, I don't know which one it was that I read, but you actually shared the story about, you were talking about price, right? And you it was a speech that you gave, and they said that it was horrible, that you were a poor speaker or something along those lines. Yeah. Do me a favor, just share that story. You're going to be able to share it way better than I am. I'm going to kill it.
This was early in my public speaking career. So I wasn't a terrible speaker. I did a good job. So I get off stage. I was a large insurance company, had me sort of in their stable of presenters, and I was doing a lot of work for them. And they have this, again, this sort of stable of presenters with the price for each. And so what happened, though, was my price was very, very low because I was young and I was just sort of starting out. And so I had these one or two reps that I would work with, and they knew I was good and they would use me a lot. But one of them came to me one day and said, "Hey, I've got to tell you, when people look at our sheet and they see what you cost, they assume you're no good. So you actually need to raise your price." So I went home and tripled my price and got more busy. And there's this relationship, there's this perceived value with price. I mean, you see this absolutely everywhere. Like, is a Rolex watch three times better than a Tudor watch? Like, not really. But like, is there a better story? There is. And what's fascinating, they do fMRI studies. So like, think about brain scan studies. They'll give people wine. They'll give people wine and measure their enjoyment of the wine. And when you show people the price, right? When you show people the price of the wine is a huge determinant of the enjoyment of the wine. In the absence of price, though, when they're just, giving people wine and seeing how much they enjoy it, people actually enjoy sort of mid-priced wine the most. But then when you add the price back, the price starts to be a determinant of that. Triad did this recently. They had the wine expert at Triad blind taste test some stuff. And he was like, "This one's a little more expensive, but I actually like this one more." So we have to be careful about these little psychological tricks where we can confuse price and value.
So I'll share the story with you. So my wife and I, years ago, we were in a wine club, and once a month we'd all go, we'd, have a limit up to $20, and it would be based on regions of the country or the world, whatever it was. And so you would take it, you'd decork it before you came in. You put it in a brown paper bag, and everyone was assigned a number. So you would put that number on it so no one knew what it was. And this one gentleman who was a sommelier brought in a unbelievably expensive bottle. It was a couple hundred dollars. And the rest of us had these $20 bottles of wine, and his came in last until everyone found out how expensive it was. They're like, actually, it really wasn't that bad.
Exactly.
We're like, wait, what?
Yeah. Working backwards to justify.
Yep. So as your progression of your books, it's shifted, but it really hasn't. I think, from the laws of wealth, even to your newest one, you talk about purpose. And for us, one of the things that, I always say that the math is the math, right? The math is the easy part. The hard part is, what is your purpose? Because that's the biggest thing that we see, that the goal for everyone is to be able to retire. And that's the finish line. Now the race is over. what we're trying to re-educate people to have a purpose. Once you retire, then what are you going to do? If you had all the money in the world, money was no object, what would you do? Where would you live? You know, what's important to you? Is it family? Is it your grandkids? Is it leaving a legacy? Is it your church? You know, whatever it is. So, you know, if you don't mind, just kind of go into that aspect of it, because I think that that's probably the biggest blind spot that people have, void, for lack of a better term, and why it's so important, especially as it relates to money and finance and life after retirement.
Yeah. So this is my soapbox of all soapboxes. I feel like purpose is the key that unlocks every door. And I think many people understand why purpose is so powerful in personal or perhaps spiritual or you know, existential pursuits. Mm-hmm. But I don't think people understand how powerful it is with money. So let me share a few bits of research there. I think I shared this in at least one of the meetings that you've been in. But there's research that shows that people who look at a picture of their families before they make a financial decision make dramatically better decisions and save more money than people who don't. Now, you can't always, you know, be looking at a picture of your family. But what it shows us is that when we tie purpose back to money, when it's about something bigger than the dollars themselves, we make better decisions and we make better choices. People who label their accounts, Ed's retired to Hawaii fund instead of just fund 123 ABC, they had 15% more on average and were 10 times less likely to sell out in a choppy market. And so we see all of these boats that get lifted by purpose. The final one I'll share is that people who worked with their advisor to get very visual with their purpose, not just like, hey, I want to retire, I need $1 million, but like, hey, I want to retire to Park City. This is where I want my house to be. This is where the grandkids are going to play. This is where I'm going to go on walks with my wife. This is where I'm going to have my coffee. This is where we have dinner. Just like really like build the dream. Make it as visual, make it as salient as those sharks were to me. Like salience is what drives behavior. So people who work with their advisor to make that dream visual and salient and vivid, they had about 73% more savings than those who did not. So purpose isn't this like nice to have. It's not this kumbaya, like out there woo-woo consideration. Visualizing your dream and getting your arms around what that's going to look like is a very practical means by which you can make better decisions with your money.
Wow. I mean, that's actually a reality. I never thought about, you know, looking at your family, a picture of your family before making financial decisions. I can't even imagine. I'm trying to do that right now. The impact that that would have as mm-hmm. to, am I doing the right thing? You know, should I be doing something a little bit different? And naming the account. So, you know, we do that, you know, it's when people retire, withdrawal order, where is it coming from? Instead of having everything commingled in one account, you know, separating it out so that people can actually see the difference.
Powerful.
So, all right, your current book that you just finished, you know, it's even more in depth into having a purpose. You know, that's actually part of the title. You know, why did you go down that path? I mean, going from behavioral finance and numbers, I mean, it just seems like incrementally it's become more personal for the individual, you know, from a behavioral standpoint, from a psychological standpoint, to having that purpose. What made that change?
There's a couple of things. One is we'll go back to the River Jordan. There's only so many ways to skin the cat of saving and investing for retirement. I mean, it's not that hard. Like, there's not 100 books I could write about best practices with managing your money. There turns out there's like 2. And so, you know, I wrote those books and I had sort of said what I had to say about that. And I hope people will read them and follow that advice. The other thing is, just as you get more of a name, as you have more money, as you have more freedom, you're more free to write the kind of stuff you want to. And so part of it was just the natural arc of my career. The book that you got a sneak peek of in Hawaii, that's the book I've always wanted to write. but have just been working on for years trying to get it right. The other thing is, probably like you, my job puts me in proximity to a lot of really wealthy people. And some of those people have taken their wealth and have spent and given it and invested it in ways that have made them truly happy and that have contributed to holistic, capital T, capital W, true wealth. Others among the very wealthy folks I know have done none of those things. And it's never enough for them, and they're not satisfied, and they're miserable, and their money has complicated their lives. And that's sad for me to see, that people who can, in some respects, have so much can simultaneously have so little. Mm-hmm. And so the reason why I wrote The Soul of Wealth and then indeed this new meaning book is Viktor Frankl, my professional hero, has this quote: ever more people today have the means to live, but no meaning to live for. It's like, how do we take that money? You've worked so hard. You made it. Like, you made it across the finish line. So don't blow it now on poor personal decisions and greed. How can we take that money, that wealth you've created, be a blessing to yourself, your family, and to the world in a way that's going to lead to enduring happiness? And that, I think, is missing. That's a far more complicated conversation, I think, than how do I create a good asset allocation?
Oh, you know what? Absolutely it is. And it brings me, I was just thinking about it as you were saying it. I want to say the poem is called The Dash. Does that sound familiar? It's
a dash on a gravestone?
Yeah, you're right, right? So it's the date that you were born and the date that the good Lord calls you home and what you've done in that interim, that dash in between. And it's not about the wealth, the cash, the cars, the homes, or anything else. It's about the people that you've lived life with and really loved along the way. And so I think at the end, it says, I'm going to paraphrase it. It says something along the lines, you know, when someone's giving your eulogy, you know, what are they going to say about your dash, right? And so that's really what it is. Does your life have meaning? And what is your purpose? And is it just at retirement, or can we create a behavior or help you understand, or at least this is what we're trying to do for those families that we serve. What is your purpose now? Your legacy doesn't have to be when you pass away and what's left behind. You know, you can leave a living legacy right now. And what does that look like, right? So it's the math, the money, that's the easy part. It's everything else that kind of goes into it when you're building a plan. That's the meat and potatoes of it. And that's what people forget. And I think that's why they're unhappy a lot of times.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, keeping with the graveyard theme, like go walk around a graveyard and look at what is there on the headstones. It says stuff like mother, brother, father, trusted friend. What's not on there is your net worth, how many times you were named best advisor of the year. You know, yeah. None of these things are on there. It's very easy for us to get lost in the minutiae of making a living or, you know, the rat race or whatever. And we forget that when the dash is all said and done, what matters most is relationships. If I may, like one of the things that I've really enjoyed, one of the frameworks that I enjoyed putting together in the new book, I would tell people, would say, what are you writing about now? And I would say, the meaning of life. And people are like, huh? Like, you know, like that's some sort of unknowable. And I mean, look, and I get it in the most dramatic sense, it is, you know, maybe it is unknowable, but what I found in the research is that people who have meaningful lives, people who have happy, joyful, fulfilled lives, it really comes down to three B's. It's believing, belonging, and becoming. So what we know from the psychological research, people whose dash is well-lived, first, they believe in something. They have a moral compass. They have values. They have rules by which they live their life, and they try and bring those rules to the world, right? They try and make whatever their idea of justice, equality, goodness, kindness, mercy. They have a personal code of conduct, and they live that, and they try and help others live it. That's the believing piece. You need a map for making sense of the world. The next one is the most important. Every research study would tell you this is the most powerful. It's belonging. Are you good to your folks, your spouse, your children, your grandkids, your community? Do you have a tribe of people, probably a small tribe, who love you and who you love, right? And then the last one is becoming. Do you have a vision for your own personal growth and your own personal betterment? That's it. That's the whole ball game. Do you have rules for living? Are you giving and receiving love? And are you striving to be a little bit better person every day? Do you have a vision for who you could become? That's it. That's the meaning of life. It's not that complicated. Again, it's hard to do, but those are the ways that we measure that dash: believing, belonging, and becoming.
Wow. Yeah. You know what? I can't think of a better way to end the podcast. I don't know exactly what else to say after that, because that really sums it all up. So, Daniel, I really appreciate it. I know how very busy you are, so I really appreciate your time. And hopefully we will see you soon at another event, because, yeah, they're great. I really enjoy it. So thank you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. All right. Take care.
Tested your fitness level, not your workout routine. I'm talking about your financial endurance. Because if saving to a 401k is the extent of your effort, it is time for you to start shaping up. And Ed Sedell is here to help you do that with The Retirement Trainer. It's his podcast to help you examine your financial stamina and learn the questions you should be asking and areas to focus on to help you get to that place you've been working so hard for, a happy, comfortable retirement. And it's not as hard as some might have made you believe. Ed's broken it down into five simple steps. It's the retirement fitness plan, which he personally created to help clarify key areas of your financial life. Learn more about the retirement fitness plan at egsifinancial.com. Then subscribe, follow, and listen to The Retirement Trainer on Apple Podcasts, your iHeart app, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. Investment advisory services offered through EGSI Investment Management, DBA EGSI Financial Group, a registered investment advisor. Insurance and annuities offered through EGSI Financial Services, Inc., Ohio License Number 102-0619.